next case of the day, which is State versus Anders. Mr. Norlinger, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Before you begin, we've got some folks coming in and out. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Norlinger, then you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, counsel for the state. This is an appeal in which Mr. Anders filed his brief pro se and has retained me to orally argue the matter for him. The issues, as I see it in the appellant's brief, involve sufficiency of the evidence, ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and an excessive sentence.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you one question with respect to your explanation of your role in this case and how it fits into our standards regarding assignments of error of ineffective assistance of trial counsel. As I understood your statement to the court, the appellant's brief was drafted by the appellant pro se, and that you have not had any role in drafting the assignments of error. Is that correct?
That's correct. If the court will review its record, I entered my appearance on the matter after the appeal had been perfected and the appellant's brief had been filed. So I didn't have any role whatsoever in filing the brief for this matter.
Very well. Thank you.
The sufficiency of the evidence argument, well, for purposes of the edification of our law students here, Mr. Anders waived speedy, waived jury, and had a trial to the bench on a first-degree sexual assault information. That information was amended twice, once before trial. Essentially, the only amendments were to extend the date range during which the purported sexual assault could have occurred. The state proceeded on a without consent theory of the first-degree sexual assault statute. And as this is a situation where it was to a judge, the standard of review is clearly erroneous on a sufficiency of the evidence. The court has to find that any rational trier of fact could not find that the essential elements in that first-degree assault were met. I'm going to refer to the victim in this case as KG for her own. Although she is mentioned in the information, I don't think it's necessarily appropriate, given the ages, to use her name. KG essentially made an allegation that she had been sexually assaulted by Mr. Anders over a course of time. That period extended from the time when Mr. Anders was her coach, either for soccer and or weight training. At various points, there may have been some interaction between them before the age of consent in Nebraska at 16. However, the court in this case found that sexual assault was proved by two prongs of the sexual assault language. Now, under no consent, under Nebraska Revised Statute 28.319, there are a number of different ways under subsection 8A, little I, 1 through 4. Some of them don't apply. There are some with regard to no force or threat, force or threat, as well as a lack of consent through words or conduct. It does not appear, based on the record and the court's finding in this case, that was sustained by the trial court. The remaining grounds that appear to have been utilized by the trial court were the language in subsection 8A1, which is coercion, and that's further defined under this court's ruling in State versus McCurdy, which says that no force is explicitly required. As the court probably recalls, McCurdy involved a victim and a boyfriend of the mother and an extended period of time where he would have sex with that individual. There was a close, somewhat familial relationship, and there was at least as I read McCurdy, some ability to control the victim. The appellant in his brief points out that the coercion as under McCurdy should not apply, specifically noting that there was no force, there's no specific familial relationship that is close, as well as Mr. Anders makes the statement in his brief that there is no real control of the victim given their limited coaching relationship for purposes of training her. There is also an allegation that the court found about deception under 28319AA4. That, as I understand my review of the record, appears to be at one point Mr. Anders is alleged to have digitally penetrated KG, saying it was for therapeutic purposes as part of a, I guess for massage and performance is the way that it was characterized by her at the trial.
And would that not be deception if the trier of fact accepted the testimony of the alleged victim?
It would. The appellant, in his brief, is making the argument that it was clearly erroneous, is how I take it, based on meeting with him and following his brief, indicating that there is substantial evidence to contradict KG's testimony at trial.
He seems to make a reasonableness argument as well, doesn't he, that it's unreasonable to think that a chiropractic manipulation would consist of digital penetration. That seems to be that no one would believe that was reasonable and would benefit the person. Is that somewhat of his argument?
Yes, that it is contained in his brief. In speaking with the appellant and preparing for oral argument, I realized that that's in an inarticulate part of his brief. My understanding is more that he's making the allegation that KG is not credible for various reasons and that it is clearly erroneous to believe any of her testimony, specifically given multiple inconsistent statements that she made throughout the course of the proceedings in terms of...
What does this court do with credibility determination by lower courts?
Normally this court is going to leave that to the discretion of the trial court, as the trial court is the one that heard and saw the evidence as well as the testimony of the individual, specifically KG, Mr. Anders, as well as the other individuals that testified about various parts of this case, including another woman under what I would characterize as 414 evidence in this case, and additionally members of the gym that Mr. Anders called through his trial counsel that seemed to contradict the testimony of KG regarding the contact in the gym for sexual purposes.
And indeed, under the standard of review that you correctly recited, we view the evidence in the light most favorable to the prevailing party, which would be the state.
That's correct.
So if you can look at evidence and see two directions, we're required by our standard of review to pick the one favorable to your opponent, right?
Correct. That is absolutely correct, Justice Castle.
And let me, and I understand your role that you've already explained. One of the things that was raised in the brief was a question about objective reasonableness, that terminology. As I understand your argument this morning, you're really not here to advocate about that.
Correct. In my review of the appellant's brief and my review of the law in preparing for this, I will tell the court objective reasonableness does not seem to be a part of the court's jurisprudence on this. And that, again, we are dealing with a pro se litigant that filed a brief. I think that's more in terms of posturing, is how I would characterize it, versus substantive legal argument that this court has applied.
Would you also agree that the standard that you recited about a rational trier of fact does implement an objective standard with respect to the trier of fact?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
So, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, and I thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Counsel, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. Your Honors, I think the biggest issue, the one that we've been discussing, is the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. And as the evidence shook out at trial, KG clearly testified that there was so much sexual contact and intercourse between her and the defendant in this case that she called it simply, it was a normal part of going to the gym. it happened so often, she couldn't recall specific dates or times because she said it was just, it had become normalized. I'd go to the gym and something would happen. It varied depending on the day. It varied starting with her age. She started going there when she was 15, and essentially he worked his way up, if you will, to having full-blown intercourse with her. It started by groping her and then digital penetration, and ultimately worked its way up to intercourse frequently. If her testimony is to be believed, which it clearly was by the district court, who sat as the trier of fact in this matter, then the evidence is clearly sufficient to support the conviction. I think the court found that it was both by lack of, by deception, which is clearly established on the purpose of the act. He kept telling her that what he was doing to her was either to increase blood flow in her legs or one particular maneuver that he did was to insert his fingers into her vagina on the pretext that it would somehow realign a muscle that caused her foot to turn outward. There may be a process to do that, but I doubt that that was it. There was also, I think the evidence, even though the district court didn't find it, I think the evidence also supported subsection 3, the lack of consent through conduct, because KG testified repeatedly, especially as time went on, that she said, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I just want to work out here. I don't want to do what she referred to as this other stuff. And so I think pretty much however you cut it, the evidence is clearly sufficient to support the defendant's convictions under these circumstances, especially under the deception. And the court also found coercion. And I think as McCurdy is probably the closest case we have. McCurdy is a little bit distinct because it involved a familial relationship, but I think if you step back from it a bit and you look at what McCurdy was really aiming at was the fact that the defendant in that case was essentially in a position of authority or some control over the victim, and I think that's clearly the case here as well. She started at the gym when she was 15. The defendant was 35 years her senior. He made it very clear to her from the outset that she was obliged to listen to him and trust him and do what he told her to do, and she would become the Olympic athlete he kept telling her she could be. A 15-year-old under those circumstances is going to basically abide by what was told to her. KG testified that she'd been playing soccer for a number of years, and that's what her other coach had told her to, so she said, well, that's what you do. You listen to your coach. You do what you're told. And that's what she did, unfortunately, to her detriment in this case.
If this case had been tried to a jury under the alternative instruction of the multiple theories of the crime, we would ordinarily not know what the jury unanimously concluded was, whether it was saying no, whether it was coercion, or whether it was deception. Here we have the finding by the trial court as to through coercion, at times it was through deception, and at times it was through both coercion and deception. If we were to conclude, hypothetically, that the evidence was not sufficient with respect to coercion, what are we left with?
You can basically fall back on the court's conclusion that deception was part of the that was part of the basis for the finding of guilt in this. I think because the state charged the lack of consent, basically the general overarching thing. If you were to reject the coercion and for whatever reason reject the deception, I think because the state charged it under the broad umbrella of lack of consent, I think you could go through the statute and look at all the essential subsections of that and see if the evidence supported any conviction under those. Because typically you don't get findings when there are alternative means for finding a defendant guilty. The court went through and made specific findings, which is fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but I don't think we are limited to just those when the overarching charge is essentially the entire category of lack of consent. I think you can go through and review the evidence and find that whether it falls into any of those categories, and if it does, then there is sufficient evidence to support the conviction.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I think unless there are additional questions, I believe we've addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel claims in our brief, some of which will have to await resolution for another day. The sentence imposed is not excessive, and unless there are further questions, we would ask that the judgment and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for a rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 1 minute, 23 seconds.
1 minute and 23 seconds, Mr. Norlinger.
Your Honors, I will switch my argument to the ineffective assistance of counsel claims that the appellant brought forward in his brief.
Before you do, and I know your time is short.
I understand, Judge.
You heard my question to your opponent about if not coercion, is deception enough? Do you agree with her answer?
Yes, I think I agree with the answer to counsel of the state. I think that's the correct understanding of the law.
Thank you. Go ahead.
There are a number of claims that we think should be preserved if the court does not reverse on insufficiency of the evidence to allow Mr. Anders to pursue in a post-conviction relief motion. Most interestingly, I think the records regarding KG's treatment by Dr. Rucker in a Trammell motion that was not sought, as that certainly could have been used for impeachment purposes, should be preserved, as well as the impeachment of Mr. Scott that's alleged. First of all, Stephen Scott was a witness that said or corroborated parts of what KG said. There appears to be failure to impeach on a motivation for a business dealing that could have benefited Mr. Scott if Mr. Anders was convicted, as well as a felony conviction that would have been within the time frame at the time of trial to impeach him for a felony conviction.
But this record's it's not sufficient to determine that now.
No, it is not. Oh, I'm asking the court to sustain those motions and allow them to proceed further under a post-conviction, as I think they've been sufficiently alleged under this court's case law. So, all right, I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That concludes arguments in State versus Anders. Counsel, you are excused. And the court is now adjourned.